Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. After much gridlock and compromise, Congress finally passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which now sits on President Biden's desk to be signed into law. The bill tackles a wide range of issues, including a historic investment of $369 billion to combat climate change, from transportation, manufacturing solar panels, and wind turbines, as well as tax credits for electric vehicles and homeowners who upgrade their houses to be more energy efficient. Joining us today about what this means for Californians is Laura Dehan, the state director for Environment California. The nonprofit has pushed for campaigns to ban single-use plastic bags, increase solar power, and get the state on track to 100% clean energy. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. I mean, this is repeatedly been called the largest investment to combat climate change in U.S. history. What are the most tangible ways this will impact Californians?
I think the first big thing is that consumers here in California can benefit directly through the really big incentives for improvements to our own homes and our own lives to be able to transition to kind of clean energy homes, from the EV incentives, where anybody can, as long as you get the right type of car, you'll be able to qualify for a $7,500 rebate on a new electric vehicle. And there's also a $4,000 rebate on a used car. And there's similar incentives for rooftop solar panels and heat pumps, which you can also use to cool your home. And so improvements to your home to make it basically to help us transition to a clean energy economy in our homes.
So that's from, the perspective of a consumer or a person. But how may we actually feel this investment in ways that we may not necessarily notice on the surface, but in the long run will benefit our everyday lives?
Really, that's where some of the biggest changes are going to happen, and why we think of this bill as a game changer, is that there's big renewed incentives for both investment in clean energy at a large scale, as well as production of clean energy at a large scale all around the country. And California is really poised to take advantage of those incentives even better than other states. One of the things that's really big as well is that the all of these tax incentives were extended for a full decade, whereas in the past, they've only ever been extended for 1 to 2, maybe 5 years at the very most. And everything I've been hearing as we've been working toward this for the last year and a half has been that having a 10-year renewal of those incentives really allows for offshore wind developers or people who might produce wind turbines to be able to plan and really go big in terms of their plans. And so what that means, I think, for us is that we're going to see a lot more clean energy getting installed in our state. It's going to make all of our clean energy and our climate goals a lot easier to reach. And it's actually going to allow us to, I think, be even more ambitious about setting bigger, bolder goals.
There is the reality, though, that although this is a historic investment, the bill is a scaled back version. I mean, it received zero Republican votes in the Senate, negotiations with Democratic Senators Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, until really like the 11th hour. So the bill is a compromise. What do you wish it included?
Well, I think there was a lot of visionary ideas on the table. You know, we would have loved if the Congress had set a goal of getting to 100% renewable energy or clean energy, by 2035. I think that was the president's goal, when he was running for office, was to get the U.S. on track for that. There was talk about, wouldn't that be great to do that? Like we have here in California, set our sights on a 100% renewable energy future, officially, codify that. And then, as you said, there has not been the political support for that. And that just shows, I think, we've got a lot more work to do to build that support in other parts of the country beyond California. It's really too bad. I think, though, for the last year plus, really since the election, since it was clear that Senator Joe Manchin was the 50th Democratic vote, we've basically known it would be really difficult to get anything perfect, you know, passed. And so we really see this as a critical, important step, far better than not doing anything, for sure. And what it does is it positions states like California to be able to just go even farther, faster. And I think that through the leadership of states and cities, we can bring the whole country, you know, toward a clean energy future, even if we don't have that law in place, you know, that would have required it.
And climate change is just one piece of this bill. I mean, the bill is more than 700 pages long. It covers expansive issues from taxes to health care. But given that you're Environment California, you're a nonprofit that focuses on climate investments, you know, the devil is in the details. Where are you critical with the Inflation Reduction Act in terms of climate change?
One of the things that is a bit of a disappointment was the agreement that any new offshore wind developments would have to be, those leases would have to be tied to the same number of leases for fossil fuel development, like offshore oil. And that was a mistake. That was not, I don't even know how that could be justified as good policy by any, you know, stretch of the imagination. And we're going to need to continue to fight any expanded, you know, fossil fuel development off of our coasts and, you know, in public lands in general, which I think has been, that fight has been made harder, you know, by that tie together. So obviously we support more clean energy development, but we're going to need to continue to oppose each and every, you know, offshore oil drilling proposal.
So yeah, what you're talking about is essentially the bill, which has provisions that would support expanded investment in domestic oil and gas production on federal lands. I mean, that sounds counterproductive when talking about a historic climate change investment.
Absolutely. It's the wrong way for us to be going, right? To expand any fossil fuel development. Right now, we should be investing taxpayer money in the solutions that the public overwhelmingly supports. There was just a new PPIC poll that came out in the last couple of weeks, and it showed that support for clean energy right now is very strong, especially here in California. More than 80% of the public really supports more offshore wind and wind energy in general, solar, you know, it's all really, really popular. And so those are the solutions that we should be investing in. And I think the California public really agrees.
When talking about wind farms, I was reading an article for Central Valley Public Radio in California, and there were concerns about the impact of offshore wind farms in terms of creating light pollution and the impact on dark oceans, ultimately marine life. Does this funding, I mean, does this come at the expense of marine life in the ocean?
Well, we are concerned about making sure that as we go big on offshore wind here in California, we're also making sure we do it in a way that really minimizes disruption on marine life and on habitats in the ocean. We work, Environment California does a lot of work on ocean protection actually as well. And we were the sponsors of the bill that kind of helped set California on track to have a big offshore wind goal. So we've been really involved in that. And we were celebrating the decision here in California last week to set the biggest goal of any state in the country. 25 gigawatts of offshore wind is the new goal by 2045. That's enough to meet about a quarter of our state's entire energy needs in 2045, when hopefully we'll be all electric, you know, in terms of how we move around and how we power and heat our homes. And so that is a lot of electricity, and it's definitely going to mean a lot of turbines. And these are really big, gigantic turbines, as tall as the Eiffel Tower or, you know, the centers of the Golden Gate Bridge. The idea is that they're going to be more than 20 miles offshore, between 20 and 30 miles offshore, really far out. And there are going to be, you know, we're anticipating there is going to be disruption, right? We're going to have to bring cables, you know, that transport that electricity onshore. We're going to need new transmission lines. That's going to be disruptive to some of our land. But continuing our dependence on burning fossil fuels to power our lives is just not working. We have to get to a clean energy future. And offshore wind is one of our best solutions. If you look at the map that the Department of Energy has put out of where do we have the best wind potential, off the Northern California coast is some of the windiest places. And the wind really picks up even at night when the sun sets. So it's a perfect complement to solar power, which is where we got a lot of our energy too.
Laura Dehan is the State Director for Environment California. Thank you so much for joining us and breaking down the climate initiatives from this bill.
Thank you, Vicky, for having me.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A daughter of Filipino farm workers in the Sacramento Valley rose to become the top jurist in California, overseeing the nation's largest court system. That's the story of Tani Cantillo Sacauye, who became the first person of color and second woman to be appointed Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. But after a 12-year term, Cantillo Sacauye announced she will retire. Appointed by then-Governor Schwarzenegger, the Chief Justice is credited with guiding the court through two big crises, the Great Recession and the COVID-19 pandemic. Her departure could also shift the ideological makeup of the court further to the left. Cantillo Sacauye was appointed as a Republican, but changed to no party preference in 2018. And just last week, Governor Newsom nominated Justice Patricia Guerrero to take her place, who joined the court in March of this year, and if appointed, would become the first Latina Chief Justice. I spoke with Chief Justice Cantillo Sacauye about her career and legacy, and the biggest challenges facing her successor.
Well, you grew up in Sacramento, and you graduated from UC Davis. I'd like to go back to kind of the beginning. What was it about your background that drew you to law?
Thank you for that question. Well, I come from a very strong Filipino community. Everyone, at least in that wave of immigrants, were farm laborers. And so we were unified because my mother picked crops and had grown up traveling from crop to crop. And there were hardships along the way and changes in school and discrimination. And my grandmother had difficulties with title to her home. And I was aware of these things, aware that one of my uncles had to leave the state to marry his French wife. So I grew up with a lot of strange happenings and a curiosity about that, even including being evicted from our home in downtown Sacramento in those days, and my mother's feeling of just disappointment and being awash in shock and sorrow that we were losing our family home. So I'd been surrounded by odd and peculiar happenings that didn't make any sense.
Were you a child when you decided that you would want to go to law school or at least pursue a profession in law?
I was not. I didn't make that decision early on at all because no one in my family had gone on to college or at that point, but I had seen the first Filipina lawyer who came to our community, and my mother took me to see her, and she gave me the elbow and said, "You could do that." And my mom was not a woman who was easily impressed, and the fact that I was there with her watching some stranger meant something. It was later on in community college when I was thinking about going on to law school.
When you touch upon the fact that your family went through faced eviction. And so that's an experience with the justice system that was pretty young for you and early on in your life. How did that shape the way you judge as a person?
It shaped me to this day, not only in how I perform my professional work, but just how I live my life and raise my kids. And that is that government has actions that affect people's real lives and have effect long term and creates memories and feelings about government and about how people were treated. So in all respects, in my view, we can never know what's going on in someone's life, and we can only hope that we can endeavor to treat them with respect and dignity as these things happen, because sometimes we're helpless, but the best we can be is not part of a machine that makes them feel alienated.
Your career as a judge or in the legal system spans decades, the last 12 of which were as California's Supreme Court Chief Justice, which made you the first person of color and only the second woman to serve in that role. What do milestones like first and second mean to you?
While they're happening, they don't feel like a milestone. They feel like I need to get in here and roll up my sleeves and do this work that I'm privileged to do. It doesn't feel like a milestone, I suppose, because everyone, at least when I came to this court, they were so welcoming. They didn't know me, but they clearly respected the office here at the Supreme Court. So though I was new to them, and they were iconic to me because they were the Supreme Court and I had been a trial judge and an appellate justice, they were gracious, and it felt like I was part of a family, and they were good and respectful, and we worked together well. So it didn't feel in the moment like this is a huge accomplishment. It felt like this is a welcoming place to be.
You're appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger, and you know, in your announcement that you were going to retire, you said that your career is really bookended by the Great Recession and also a global pandemic. What do you believe were the key factors in the court in terms of successfully weathering these two huge external challenges?
Thank you. Yes, I took office as Chief Justice in 2010 and became the leader head of the largest law-trained judiciary, not only in the country, but probably the world, and the most diverse. And so we depend on public funding. And public funding, as you might recall, 12 years ago was being slashed, and we didn't know the end, and they wouldn't spend a dollar to save five. We were closing courtrooms, courthouses, appellate justices like myself and some trial judges. We took pay cuts. We worked a day without pay in order to keep the doors open. And so it really meant at that time to spread the word. We are in need of a functioning judicial system. And we need to first clean ourselves up. We need to cut corners. We need to do an audit. We need to make ourselves fit for the long haul at a budget. And so I went in and I surveyed, and I went in and let people go took a survey, determined what we could downsize. And also at that point, I engaged the lawyers, our best advocates of California, explained our budget, needed them in the legislature and in the governor's office to help also spread our message that you need an adequate, sustainable court in order to be there for justice. Because while the Great Recession is going on, people's lives are folding. We need to be open. And it took a few years, but we accomplished our goal. We made friends. We made comrades. People understand the branch better. And now in my final year, we brought home the largest judicial branch budget in its history.
Fast forward to a pandemic, which severely impacted the court system and courts across the country. How did that impact the job that you did every day?
It was, like everyone, unprecedented. And we had no playbook. All we knew, all I knew, is we were going to stay open. We are staying open, damn it. And we are going to find a way to make this work. All of the courts were in various stages of accessing justice through remote technology, and we sped it up. And we had the goodwill of the judges and the lawyers and the court staff, and we all rode in the same direction. And we brought along people who were doubters, and there were some who didn't take to it, but the majority of judges and the majority of lawyers and professional staff, we understood our public service role, and we endeavored to do it. Was it perfect? Could it have been much better? Sure, but at the time we were, as they said, I said, we're on the bullet train and we're throwing out the track as we're going at, in front of us. So I'm proud of the work we've done and how we've maintained and able to keep our doors open. And now looking at best practices that we learn to keep and to use at the user client's option.
Just like everything, everything got slowed down tremendously. What are the challenges that still exist because of the pandemic?
Well, because of the pandemic, as you know, every state, all the state and all the counties and the cities had different overlapping health orders, but all of them had a social distancing order and also had stay away or shelter in place orders. Courthouses are buildings, and we normally bring in on every day, we call in 200 or 300 jurors to hear the jury trials. And at this point, with during pandemic, we couldn't bring in enough people with social distancing. We just don't have that room. So we were bringing in smaller groups of people like 25 and 50 in order to vet for jury service. Also, we had the difficulty of jail and prisons having their own outbreaks. So we couldn't transport people who for their day in court because they were under quarantine, they were infected, and it would infect employees and court staff and court watchers. We also had the added problem of the fact that shelter in place, jurors weren't coming even though they were being subpoenaed, understandably. So we had to suspend jury trials because we just couldn't go through with them. So as a result, in some counties now, we have a backlog of jury trials in felonies and an unlimited civil. We've managed, though, in other categories with remote access to actually address backlog and get ahead of our caseload, particularly in civil, like family law and dependency, child welfare cases, because juveniles are more apt to want to handle their case remotely. And they want to do it at the kitchen table, and they bring their parents along to do it. And so we've been able to really reach a population and be more inclusive in family law matters.
Yeah, because ultimately, when you're talking about these cases, they impact everyday lives, which you just what we started our conversation with.
Yes, yes. And as you know, in times of great crisis in the state, that's when justice is needed most because people are laid off, they're losing their homes, there's wage theft, there's corruption, there's theft. There's a lot of conservatorship issues, dependency issues. Families are having challenges and they need court services. And so we really see our role as even stronger in times of crisis.
When it comes to California's third branch of government, it's not necessarily, you know, the center of everyday conversations. What do you wish people knew more about the California Supreme Court?
Well, I thank you. You're absolutely right. The judicial branch is a bit shrouded in mystery, and it's a little more complicated, but I wish what people knew about the Supreme Court and the courts of appeal and the trial courts is that we are a third branch of government like the other two, co-equal, and we are dedicated longtime career public servants providing access to justice. And we are making an effort to make the courts accessible to you. We are public servants. We take that role seriously. And we also want you to know that the courts exist for you to press your rights. The legislature passes proposals, the governor signs those proposals into law, but it is in the judicial branch that we enforce those laws and clarify them for you. So we're a service organization, and it's important that the courts not be forgotten, because if you defund or you end up marginalizing the funding of the courts, you're only really inflicting harm upon yourself should you ever need to turn to justice.
Right, because your budget can change drastically and probably has over the last 12 years that you've been Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Frighteningly so. And it's part because we are such a tiny sliver of the state budget general tax pie. We're a tiny little sliver, and we're also the sliver that is basically discretionary income. Other parts are mandated funding, of course, for social services, for education, a lot of those, understandably. But we're so tiny, but we're also vulnerable because there is no minimum floor to funding the judiciary.
When it comes to your retirement, this is your last year. When did you begin thinking about retirement?
Well, I could have retired 3 years ago, right before the pandemic, but I wasn't ready. There were still things that I wanted to, with others, pull across the finish line. And so in this year, I thought about it knowing I'd have to re-up. I've said there's no reason for me to think about leaving except for now I have to re-up. And re-upping means I have to think about whether or not I can give another 12 years fully to this job. And then I have to think, and I thought, well, I've had 32 years as a jurist. Would I do 12 more? Or would it be better to have someone come in fresh and start his or her administration and take the branch in yet other expansive ways? So it was really thinking about the future and how long I would stay with 12 because retention was imminent. And so that's what started me to think about it and to really sort of drill down to how many more years. And if, for example, if there were a recession that were coming, and as has been rumored in the media, I would not feel right leaving in the middle of it. So I would have to ride that out. And I don't know how many years that would be. And so those were the kinds of things that led me to think about not re-upping this year.
Is it bittersweet?
Yes, it is, as all huge decisions are.
Governor Newsom just recently nominated Justice Patricia Guerrero to take your place as Chief Justice, who was just sworn into the Supreme Court in March of this year. Did that nomination come as a surprise to you, given it's only been, you know, about 5 months?
Oh, absolutely not. I do sit on COJA as the Commission on Judicial Appointments Chair. I probably can't gush because we haven't had her hearing, but I will say Governor Newsom made a fine choice. I congratulate him on it. And she has 5 more months than I had when I came on. I came on from the Court of Appeal. So she's going to be great. And she's in the branch is in good hands. And I'm not surprised.
Not only the third woman following you, but the first Latina to serve in this role.
Yes, very exciting for the justice. Very exciting for California. Very exciting nationally as well.
I want to go back just, you know, about 4 years ago when you publicly renounced your Republican Party affiliation and you switched to no party preference. And that was in the wake of the confirmation hearings for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. What happened during the course of those hearings that made you want to switch from the Republican Party to no party preference?
Thank you. That's a great question, because I had been thinking prior to that hearing and watching it to changing to no party preference, because as judges, we don't have a party, really. It has a political denomination, makes no difference to the work we do. And I'd been thinking at it for some time. I just didn't have reason to act upon it. But during those hearings, I saw that it felt like to me a little bit of a undermining of the whole public policy and the judiciary. And I have two adult daughters who were younger adults then, and I tried to see it through their eyes. And at the same time, some of the questioning and the way the questioning, I can't put my finger on it, but it was reminiscent to me of the time when I was a young trial attorney, prosecutor, the only woman in the courtroom. And the environment was not comfortable. And I hadn't seen that in a long time. And I hadn't even really thought about it. But watching those, I remember I had my earbuds in, and I'm going through the airport and I'm traveling for work and I am fixated on this hearing. And I came away with a bit of kind of deja vu a little bit. I just felt that it was time to make the decision. And I didn't announce it. I didn't think it would be a big deal. I just changed it and told my folks, you probably should change my bio. And it surprised me that the press found it some months later.
Yeah, I read about it in the Associated Press at that time. When it comes to politics, I understand your position is impartial as a judge. How has your view, though, of politics changed throughout the course of working in law?
Well, I believe definitely we've seen policies change in the last decade, and that's natural and fluid and important and that necessary. Every generation decides how it's going to craft and the laws that guide its community, its society. And that's something I respect as a jurist and respect as a person. At first glance, I may think this is not what I'm used to, but I don't know that it's wrong. And so I think it's up to the decision makers who are answerable to the public and their constituents to decide what they think is the best direction for California. And as jurists, as you know, we often say in some of our more controversial opinions, we say, we do not opine on the wisdom of this policy because we just don't. That's not our role in a democracy.
Well, what I'm hearing is listening and staying open-minded are key. But a part of that is also having diverse viewpoints. And you switched your party affiliation to no party preference, but previously were a Republican. When you retire, there will only be one Republican appointee left on the court. We have a state legislature that is overwhelmingly Democrat, our governor as well. Are you concerned the court, or even in California, politically, may be shifting too far in one direction?
I don't have that fear. I know that when you have seven principled people, my colleagues, weigh in, that there's no room for politics. Our positions are supported by authority and citation. And if there isn't support for, we'll even say to each other, I read this paragraph, do you have any authority, legal authority or citation in support of that? Before we say it, I'm not comfortable saying that without some legal authority with which I agree is pertinent. So I don't see it. Our opinions are written publicly to be read and to be checked and fact checked. And so I think that's the judiciary, maybe more than any other branch of government, relies on public trust and confidence in the work we do. And we do it in a transparent way where you can read it. If it starts to sound and read politically, because of political views, then we've failed in our job.
Do you think that trust has been eroded in recent years, especially in light of recent Supreme Court decisions, and this is at the national level, that have been divisive and have prompted people to demonstrate and protest for one position or the other?
I think that's a pretty accurate statement. I believe that there is far more discussion about court decisions and the United States Supreme Court decisions in particular. I think there is a risk of that at the high court, which I hope people begin to understand is very different from how state court operates. We are not lifetime appointed. Justice Guerrero is going to have to run for a 12-year term. But no, I do firmly believe that we are in times like we've never been, where the courts legitimacy and its objectivity is at issue.
In the past 12 years, you've presided over and penned some big decisions. Is there a specific case or decision that you presided over that will stick with you and perhaps will have the most significant impact on current and future Californians?
I think that all of our cases at the Supreme Court, whether I authored them or my colleagues did, are all significant because they wouldn't be here if they weren't. We don't grant review on many cases, but the ones we do are because they are statewide importance and impactful. I don't think any one case stands out to me. I think what stands out and what is impactful is that we work together collegially and we are not divisive. And so I think the California Supreme Court has historically, and through me still, has been able to be of service to the public and litigants because we clarify and guide the law in a way that you won't have to worry that next year one vote will change it.
Your retirement is the close of a chapter. You also believe that each generation must renew and refresh our constitutional democracy. What does that look like to you?
That means that those of us who are the stewards in these positions really need to be out in the community describing the public service work that we do and that our sister branches do, and that we describe civics and critical thinking and collaboration, that we tell our young people and maybe even remind some of our middle-aged and old people like myself that we need to preserve and we need to work together for this government. And that means understanding it, and it means civility, and it means respect for each other's points of view, which I really tried to work and push a civics initiative for K through 12, with the judiciary leading the way in such a way that, because we're leading, we're going to emphasize the judiciary, but we are also including our executive and legislative branches, and judges and lawyers are out there every day as part of the Power of Democracy civics initiative started here by, that I started in 2012.
Oh, so for about 10 years now.
Yes.
Finally, 4 months from now, your term ends. Any idea? Have you been mulling over what you're going to be doing, what 2023 looks like?
I haven't had a lot of mulling because life here at the court goes on and we are still sprinting. I have a moment's abstract thought about the fact that come January 2023, my email box won't be filled with crises and exclamation points and urgents. Urgent! I hope that I never really see that again. But I don't know, but I'm kind of excited about a new adventure. I'm excited about, I have faith. I believe a little bit in fate. I'm excited to see what the next brings, if anything.
Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for your interest. Nice talking with you, Vicky.
That is my conversation with Tani Cantil-Sakauye, the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, who will retire at the end of the year. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Regarded as the Sundance of the Sierra, the Nevada City Film Festival returns this month. The films will screen at the Onyx Theater, Pioneer Park, and the historic Nevada Theater, California's oldest existing theater. The 22nd anniversary of the Nevada City Film Festival will feature a list of international feature-length and short films. Joining us today to talk about the festival is Executive Director Jesse Locks, as well as Nancy Svensson, director and producer of Passing in the Shadow of Everest. Welcome. Good morning.
Thanks for having us, Vicky.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, Jesse, starting with you, 2 years of a pandemic, you're now going to welcome people to the film festival. Y'all must be so excited this month.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we made a shift in 2020 and we did the whole drive-in like so many film festivals. And then last year we kind of got caught in between everything. But this year we're so ready. We're so ready to have filmmakers here and have everybody come together and just watch these great movies that were made either right before the pandemic or during the pandemic. They're just really beautiful, creative stories about the human experience. And I think it's something that we definitely need right now. The timing is perfect.
I'd love to learn more about the history of this festival, because you wouldn't necessarily think a small, charming town in the foothills would actually have international recognition the way that your festival does.
Yeah. So we started out as a filmmakers film festival. So it was definitely just, you know, a ragtag group of kids making movies that wanted to show them to their friends and family. And it's grown into something that we could have never imagined, right? And it's bringing filmmakers from, you know, 15 different countries. And we receive over like 400 or 500 films that we watch, and we narrow it down to the selection that we have. And, you know, we draw people from all over Northern California, and it's just a, I think we have to credit like this unique place. I mean, Nevada City is this arts and culture hub that's always been known as that. You know, it's absolutely beautiful. It's surrounded by the Tahoe National Forest. And so it's a bit of a respite for folks to come up here and enjoy movies, you know, during the evenings, and then go out and play in, you know, in the natural setting around us, and, you know, just really enjoy themselves.
All right. I want to get to more than 400 films that you had to narrow down. What went into that process, narrowing down that selection and into what people are going to experience this month?
Yeah, I mean, every film festival is different in how they decide on, you know, what films make the cut. And for us, it's really about like a film that's different. The story is different. It's done in a way that we haven't seen or heard before. We love to support first-time filmmakers. And oftentimes that will come in the form of a short film, right? That's kind of when filmmakers are the most experimental. They're just starting out. They're really kind of finding their style. And it allows you, you know, the audience to see the creative process and the sense that these people are just starting their careers in filmmaking, and then they'll go on to have, you know, very long and, you know, incredible careers. And so, you know, we look for stories that really tug at the heart. We talk about bittersweet and a little bit nostalgic. And so those are the kinds of things that we love to see. And we love to support, again, the stories that haven't been told in the mainstream media.
Well, when you talk about bittersweet, I mean, Nancy, I want to bring you in your documentary about the first Nepali woman to summit Everest in 1993. Tell us about your documentary.
Well, it is the story of Basang Lamu Sherpa, who, you know, after actually three attempts, did summit Mount Everest in 1993, and made history there. She is the most important contemporary hero in Nepal, and she's very famous there. You know, she's a big statue, she'll have a postage stamp, but nobody's ever told her story outside of Nepal. And I came to the story. I am a first-time filmmaker. This is my first feature film, but I was actually, this is my second career. I had a whole career in corporate America, so to speak, and I was having dinner with my sister and her relatively new husband on Dorji Sherpa. We all live in the Bay Area, and Dorji told me the story of his sister, Basang. And I was just so incredibly captivated by this story. And, you know, and it just felt like, I mean, this is a story that has to be told. And anyway, so that was over 10 years ago. And so, you know, through, you know, sort of my own mini Everest, honestly, you know, this film has come together with the help of a tremendous team of really seasoned and award-winning professionals from, you know, the filmmaking industry. But it's a pretty incredible story that I feel had the danger of being lost to history. This woman who overcame so many incredible obstacles that it's hard for us, you know, in you know, 2022 with our Western lens to truly understand. And that's why I felt it was such an important film to make.
Yeah. I mean, the images are striking, obviously, of Mount Everest, but then you have such wonderful historical images and video really chronicling what she went through at a time when, you know, we have Free Solo and also The Alpinist, which is on Netflix. What have guests or what have viewers taken away? Because you've taken this documentary to so many film festivals already.
We have been so incredibly fortunate, and we're so excited to be in Nevada City. But yes, you know, it's a very different story. I mean, I tell people that than what you're seeing in a lot of these, you know, really adrenaline-driven climbing films. I will say, exclusively about men. So, you know, this is a film that I, you know, liken to a freedom fighter story that just happens to take place on Everest. Because really for Pasong, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, she was an indigenous woman in a Hindu kingdom. She had basically no rights. You know, she didn't speak the official language. She spoke, a dialect of her own indigenous language. She had to learn the national language, Nepali, which she would have spoken with a very heavy accent. She was backward, you know, from the hills. She would not even have been, she would have been taught that she couldn't even make eye contact with these government officials, et cetera. And yet in our film, you know, she has an audience with the prime minister where she looks him in the eye and says, you know, I need your help. This is for, you know, for the Nepali people. This is for the pride of Nepal. And she spoke of herself not as a Sherpa woman, which she was, but she spoke of herself as a Nepali woman, which again, at the time, was pretty revolutionary. It was audacious. So she had to contend with not just, you know, the prejudice of, I mean, she was a female in a, you know, male dominated society. She was an indigenous woman in this Hindu kingdom. She was a cultural religious minority, but then she had to contend with the perils of the mountain itself.
Yeah. You know, Jesse, just after talking with Nancy, I would imagine this encapsulates, you know, the wide array of films and pieces that people will take in this month.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we first watched Nancy's film, it was, of course, absolutely, this should be in the film festival. But I mean, that's the idea of what you get when you come to the Nevada City Film Festival. You get to be taken to these different places, and you really are given this unique view, vision, you know, lens of people from a different place, and that you get that heartfelt experience, and you can go away learning something or knowing or maybe feeling a little bit better about the world at large. And I think that that's the most important thing for us in the film festival is, like, you know, there's so many films and movies out there that you can watch on so many different platforms, but really what we're trying to curate for audiences is that experience where you do have an intimate, authentic relationship with the subject in the film, you know, and it could be in just an animated narrative or, you know, whatever it could be. But also that you're able to form with the filmmakers and hear, you know, the backstory and really learn so much more to give you like a comprehensive experience of not just the story, but the art form itself.
And it's more than just watching films, right? I mean, you have other fun things for people and families to do.
Yeah, I mean, we try and start them young too. So we do like a free children's program that we always work with a film festival that, you know, specializes in international children's shorts. And so we always do something like that. And, you know, we've had virtual reality, you know, we've tried to stay on the cutting edge, even in our small town community, of like what's happening in the film industry and give, you know, our audiences a taste of that. So, you know, they, no matter where they live, they can still know what's going on in, you know, Nepal or some far away place, or even just like down the street in Sacramento or the Bay Area. You know, I think that that's what the power of film is all about, is to be able to learn about other people and hear their stories.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask both of you what each of you are looking forward to watching. Nancy, I know you're a director and producer, but what are you looking forward to?
I am looking forward to an opportunity to see, you know, films showcased by, you know, that films that you don't normally get to see. I guess that is the opportunity at this festival and at many of these festivals is these incredible, you know, works of art that you don't necessarily get to see, or you have to wait a long time to see. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to hear their directors and the people that made them talk about the process.
Yeah, and the backdrop of Nevada City is pretty charming as well. Jesse, what about you? What are you looking forward to?
I'm just so excited to have the filmmakers here again. It's been, you know, kind of quiet and lonely without them. And it, I mean, the film festival is not a festival without them. And in addition to that, it's like to have the audiences to be able to forum with them is so important to us. And I mean, we have a really good group of filmmakers coming this year. We've got Terry Zwigoff, who did Ghost World, which we're going to show, and Bad Santa. We also have, you know, this great animated feature called Quantum Cowboys, that's just really unique and different. And it's like, it's unlike anything you've seen before. So, I mean, there's just so many different films, short, feature length, documentary, narrative. And then, of course, the filmmakers that are coming from all over the United States and even outside of the country, to Little Nevada City, which you can definitely bump into them, you know, walking down the street, Broad Street, or, you know, in the theater. So it's not like most film festivals where you're a little bit distanced from one another. This is like we're in it together for 3 days.
It'll be bustling in the best way. Jesse and Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is Nevada City Film Festival Executive Director Jesse Locks and Nancy Svensson, Director and Producer of Passing in the Shadow of Everest. The film festival takes place in Nevada City next week through the weekend of August 26th. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.